fleeing Nazi Germany to Shanghai, China.
We left for Shanghai in desperation because there was no other place to go. August 25th, 1939. And we were the last ship off, literally.
That's Ely Wax. We talked to him and his sister Deborah Strobin about their memoir, An Uncommon Journey. And what can we learn from those who have taken a stand against hate and injustice, risking everything to do so?
And I hope that the book takes these dramatic stories that I described that took place in other places, and by the end, leaves readers really thinking about how do I think about these things in the situations I find myself in.
That's A.L. Press. We talked to him about his wonderful book, Beautiful Souls. It's about the motives of those who put a higher good above their own personal safety. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Holocaust Remembrance Day is marked this week in the U.S. Memoirs about the Holocaust abound that recount the experiences of Jews who managed to stay alive during the brutal years of Nazi rule. Or there are those writings, like the Diary of Anne Frank or the novels of Irene Nemirovsky, that were published after their authors had already perished in the camps. But today, we talk with two siblings, Ely Wax and Deborah Strobin, who escaped the fate of so many other Jews when their parents took them out of Nazi Europe to flee to a very foreign and far place, Shanghai, China. The story of the Shanghai Jewish refugees is one that had barely been told until now, with the publication of their memoir, An Uncommon Journey, From Vienna to Shanghai to America, A Brother and Sister Escaped to Freedom During World War II. The family left Europe at the very last minute, sailing out of Genoa, Italy, just before World War II was declared. Ely Wax is an artist and former fashion designer. His sister, Deborah Strobin, is a philanthropist. I sat down with them in Ely Wax's Manhattan apartment to hear them tell the story of their uncommon journey. The book alternates the narratives of each sibling, providing a fascinating contrast between their accounts, not least because Ely was 8 years older than his sister. He was 12 when they left Europe, and she was only 3. Ely, you're so much older than your sister. When problems began happening in Vienna, where you both were born, tell us what it was like for you when Vienna began to become such a more dangerous place.
As far as I'm concerned, Vienna was a dangerous place for me before Hitler. There was always anti-Semitism in Vienna. And I went to a Catholic school, and we were only 5 Jewish boys in the class. And every morning we had to stand outside of the class because the teacher felt we were disturbing them. So I was aware of anti-Semitism in the 36, 37.
So when did you begin to understand that something different was going on?
Quite early in my life. I was radicalized at the age of 6, I believe, and telling my parents, why don't we go to America? Why are we staying here?
And when, you know, things began to get even more intense in Austria, give us just a little bit of kind of the historical background to this.
Well, in 1938 was the Anschluss, which was the German occupation of Austria. And before that, the Austrian government, which was headed by Chancellor Schuschnigg, had a plebiscite to decide whether we should join Germany or remain in independence. And 2 days before Hitler marched into Austria, there were flags all over Vienna saying, independence, yes, meaning yes, we should be independent and not join Hitler. Hitler marched in the next day, and that same day, flags all over Vienna were welcoming Hitler. It was the exact opposite. And they were threw flowers in the paths of German tanks. It was known as the Blumenkrieg, the War of the Flowers. So he was welcomed by the German population.
So you as an 11-year-old, is that right? What was it like for you?
I went to a school. It was a Jewish school. We're all Jewish students. But the teacher was Aryan, was not Jewish. And he was always very very good to us. We never felt there was never any conflict. The day after Hitler marched in, the school was closed for 3-4 days. When the school opened again, our teacher appeared with a red armband, a swastika on his armband, and said to us, "You are guests in this country, and you have to behave like guests." And we all looked at each other. What is he talking about? We were born here. How can we be guests in a country like that? And I came home and I said to my parents, "What the teacher just told us." And my parents said, "Keep quiet, don't say anything. You're only going to get us into trouble, and your fathers will be put into concentration camps, so keep quiet." That was the first real introduction.
Now, you were very, very young. Do you remember any of this time, Deborah?
What I remember is what my mother told me. So from my perspective, I was going on vacation, and I was having an adventure. In order to protect me, my parents told me that we were going on vacation.
You were talking about when you decided to leave.
When we left Vienna. So I really had no concept of what was happening. However, things started to gel after a while when I was wondering why our accommodations on the ship were not as wonderful as the honeymooners who were on the ship, which later on my brother explained to me. Of course, when we wrote the book, it was the first time I found out we were not going on vacation.
I want to ask you just a little bit about your parents, too, because so many Jews did not get out, waited too long, thought that things weren't going to be all that bad. Your family got out in 1939. Why did they do that? Why do you think your parents had that kind of perspective? And who helped them get out?
Specific circumstances happened, and we were lucky. And the circumstance was that our mother was a Polish citizen, and all Polish citizens were threatened with deportation. The hat tailor that worked for my father was a high functionary in the Nazi party. The hat tailor. My father was a custom tailor, the tailoring business, and his hat tailor was a functionary, high functionary in the Nazi party. And he was able to get extensions for my mother. 6 months, 6 months, 6 months. Finally, in February of 1939, he said, I can get your mother only one more extension, which expires August 31st, 1939.
And this is an amazing date because it's one day before war broke out.
Exactly right. So we left for Shanghai in desperation because there was no other place to go. August 25th, 1939. And we were the last ship out, literally. People left later, but they had to go by train via Russia.
Your father also had very particular circumstances.
Well, the circumstances was my father fought in the Romanian army in the First World War. He was taken prisoner by the Polish-Austrian army. And as a prisoner of war, he became protected by the Swiss government as a prisoner of war. And he had a document that stated, among other things, that the host country where he lived has to extend him all the courtesies because he is a former prisoner of war and is protected by the Swiss government. Whenever he was stopped on the street in Vienna by German officers, he flashed the documents, they saw all those stamps, Swiss government, and they left him alone. The fact it was dated 1917, they didn't see. So he was fine, he didn't have to leave. And beyond that, because he was stateless, his marriage, Jewish marriage to my mother, was never accepted. So they were never formally married in the eyes of the Austrian government. And we were then citizens of Poland. We were on my mother's passport. So we equally were threatened with deportation. My father was fine. So that is the background story of why we left. And I have to say, a lot of people lived in denial. They didn't think it's not going to happen to us. And a large part of my mother's family didn't leave, and they didn't survive. Mm-hmm. So people that escaped was luck to a large extent. Some had foresight, but I would say we were lucky, basically.
And did you know that you were going to Shanghai, or did your father, did your parents expect that they could find a port, a refuge somewhere else than that?
No, we knew it was booked Shanghai. Nobody wanted to go to Shanghai, but Shanghai was the only place in the entire world that you could go to that had no restrictions. All you had to do is book passage. You couldn't come here, the quota system. Every country had restrictions of one kind or another.
You, Deborah, don't remember the boat very well. What is your first strong memory of your own that doesn't come from, say, photographs?
I think my first memory was when we came to Shanghai, we were all separated. I was so used to being with my brother and my father and my mother. So my mother and I were separated, and my father and my brother were separated in living quarters. They put us in an area that were like bunk beds. It's almost like a dormitory. And that was my first experience, and it was frightening to me. Also, everybody looked different to me. I've never seen any Asians. I just wasn't even sure where I was.
So you were put in a dormitory. This was a kind of refugee facility?
Yes. Yes, it was.
And who was running this? What was this?
There was a Jewish a community there of Russian Jews and Sephardic Jews, and they helped out originally, helped people to resettle. We all wound up in the dormitories at first. But my father wouldn't, we can't live in a place like that, and we moved out the very next day. But quite a few people spent the entire war years in those dormitories.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Eli Wax and Deborah Strobin, who are siblings. They've both written together the memoir An Uncommon Journey. It's a story of how they escaped Nazi-occupied Austria and went to Shanghai as children before ultimately ending up in the United States. So how was it that Shanghai had a Jewish community?
Shanghai had a Jewish community were mostly Russian Jewish community who settled in Shanghai after the revolution. And they also had a Sephardic Jewish community, very wealthy communities, family name like Sassoons. And they came to Shanghai with the British during the Opium Wars in the early 19th century. They were known as the Baghdadi Jews.
So Shanghai, put us there. Tell us what it was like for you to be in that community.
Well, It was, first of all, a great culture shock. An entirely different way of life from what we had before. Didn't speak the language. People looked strange to us. We never saw any Chinese. So it was a very difficult adjustment. And then we lived under Japanese occupation. It was the Japanese, actually, who let us into Shanghai because they controlled Shanghai. And they didn't care who came. And then during the war, we had to live in a ghetto. But there's a story to this, and the story is the Germans kept pushing Japanese, what are you doing about solving the Jewish problem? So they put us in a ghetto, never used the term Jew, said all stateless people who came to Shanghai after 1938 have to live in a designated area. Now, there's a reason why the Japanese did not kill us. And the reason goes back to the Russo-Japanese War of 1905. Japanese went to Europe looking for financing of the war effort. None of the European royal houses would support them because they were all related to the Tsar and there were the pogroms going on at that time. It was Jewish money that supported the Japanese war effort. Japanese won that war, and they remembered that.
So it's beneficial to be on the right side.
And also what also helped, they bought into the German propaganda that the Jews are controlling the United States, they're all powerful. So they felt if they treat us well at the end of the war, they would get a better deal. Well, we were not going to disabuse them of that notion.
Mm-hmm. So, you know, they said, well, in case we lose the war, we'll do okay. And there was also a really funny story, which you say, you know, may or may not be true, but a story about what the rabbi in Shanghai told the Japanese general.
Actually, that happened in Japan, because before they all wound up in Shanghai, they had to go to Japan first, to Kobe. There was a large community of Jews in Kobe, Japan. And the commander there wanted to see the head of the Jews. Well, there's no head of the Jews. So they sent the rabbi. And the commander asked the rabbi, why do the Germans hate you so much? And the rabbi answered, because we are Asian, like you.
And that is, in fact, the Germans used to call the Jews an Oriental race.
That's right, that's right. And the commander smiled when he heard that, and he satisfied him.
Which is such a wonderful comment on the social construction of race.
That's right, that's right.
Now, for you, Deborah, you were a young, very young girl, but you were growing up. This is a 12-year journey. So what was Shanghai like for you?
Well, I don't ever remember really being a child in Shanghai because responsibilities that I had were so different as I learned when we came to the United States. It was frightening, basically. I was taught to be afraid of everything. We lived in very small quarters. We basically lived in a room and a half. So there were four of us living there for close to 11 years. And there wasn't really any privacy. It was infested with all kinds of bugs. My brother was laying on the floor. My mother had to put up a mattress for him, something on the floor. I was being elevated into a cot because I was frightened of everything. We lived next door to a hospital for little children. So for me, at an early age, I could see, in other words, when the children died in the hospitals, they were wrapped up in blankets and thrown out on the street. So my mother used to always tell me, when you go to school, do not touch anything. So we learned to just go around it, and it was a common thing for me to see bodies. It's something that, as a child, I mean, and I can't imagine anybody else in any other country seeing a body and not being frightened. To me, it was garbage, unfortunately. It felt like garbage. It was treated like garbage. And I basically had responsibilities when I went to school. I went to Kaduri School. The Kaduris were very generous Jews who opened up schools in Shanghai. And in the Kaduri School, I had to learn at an early age how to cook. Now, I was about 6-7 years old. And then when the war broke out between the Japanese and the Americans, I had to learn first aid. The next thing I knew is they put a cap on me with a red, star, and gave me bandages. And when the war broke out, go out there and help. And I still remember running out there. All I had was bandages, and I could see that some of the people and the Chinese, limbs were missing, were hanging off their feet. During the bombing, when the Americans bombed an area and the Japanese, during the bombing, the schools were hit. One of the schools was hit, and children were running out. Some people were on stretchers, on pedicabs, on rickshaws. And I could see some of them with some of their limbs hanging off. And I thought as a child I was supposed to go find it and go put it back on and use a bandage just to put it back on. So I really didn't have any concept of anything else. I don't remember being a child playing with toys. I didn't have any. The toy I had was something my father found on the street, some kind of a plastic doll, which certainly I didn't befriend it. And my father tried to make clothing for her so that I would have a sense of a toy. I never knew that.
When your mother said, don't touch things, I mean, one of the things she also warned you about was not to play with Chinese children. Talk a little bit about the relationships between the Jewish community and the Chinese that you lived among.
We pretty much, I think it was more we ignored them. We were just told not to go near them, not to touch them. And there's a story later on where I did not listen to my mother. A next-door neighbor had a little Chinese girl that we became friends with that I ultimately met 5 years ago.
Yeah, that's amazing. You went back to Shanghai. You went back to the place that you lived.
And I wanted to take pictures of the home I lived in, and I wasn't able to get into that one. And this woman comes out of a cab, speaks perfect English, who lives in Texas. Would you like to see? I'll ask my parents, who've been living there all these years, if they will let you in. And, of course, they let us in. I came with a group of friends. And as it turns out, when we came upstairs, the older couple right away first of all, it was so unique to see anyone who would go to this area as a sightseer. Nobody would even think of it. And when I got up there, she remembered that was that little redheaded girl, and it was a little redheaded boy, and I remember playing with my daughter. Needless to say, we looked at each other. Here was this daughter that I haven't seen in 50-some, God knows how many years, and we played with each other. It was an unbelievable feeling. It was just... It's hard to imagine. It was almost haunting.
Haunting?
Haunting in a way, because memories flowed back. Right then and there, they flew back, and memories came on. I could still see that child playing hopscotch outside, and I could still see or feel the arm of my mother pulling me away. And all these thoughts came together right at the moment. And the people I came with were tearing up completely. It was an emotional experience, to say the least.
You're listening to Writer's Voice, and we're talking with Deborah Strobin and her brother Ely Wax about their memoir of finding refuge during World War II as Jews in Shanghai, China. Their memoir is An Uncommon Journey. So the war comes to an end, and now your lives are going to be in transition. In fact, you didn't leave Shanghai as early as some of the other Jews. What was going on?
Well, I left earlier because I got a scholarship through the American Joint Distribution Committee, who were a Jewish agency who were resettling Jewish people, mostly in the United States, and some went to Australia. And I got a scholarship to the head of the agency, Mr. Charles Jordan, to study art in Paris. So I left earlier. I left in 1948 and spent a couple of years in Paris. And they left about a year later, just after the communists came in. But leaving Shanghai was not a problem at that point, in addition to which the Congress passed a Displaced Persons Act that permitted all refugees who have not permanently settled in any place could come to the United States outside of the quota system. So that helped. Some people went to in Israel. Some people went back to Austria. So,
which surprises you?
Very much so. Because I didn't want no way go back to Austria. Mm-hmm. I didn't go back for a visit eventually for a short time, and I didn't regret not living there. And yet, some people went back and they're happy there. So,
it seems the war was over in 1945. The Japanese surrendered, and after the U.S. dropped the bombs on Nagasaki and Hiroshima. You were staying, 3-4 years longer. That's an awfully long time.
It took that long. It took that long because the quota system was still intact. The quota system was a law that was passed in 1921, which was based on the population of the United States, like people of different origins. People of German origins were the largest group in the United States, so they had the largest quota. Romanian and Polish were a very small part of the population, so their quota was tiny. Like the Romanian quota was about 3,000 a year, and we would probably still be waiting today. So people waited first. It took a couple of years. The first people that left were people that came from Germany, German Jews, and their quota numbers were good. And the people who had registered early. So it took a number of years. Those wheels, the bureaucracy, moved very slowly. So it isn't like the war is over and everybody boarded the ship and left. Okay, it took about four or five years. Eventually, everybody left.
Well, I remember looking out the window because my father was still not going anyplace because his choices of Australia was not Israel was no way. He said he was no way he was going. He was waiting for the United States. Needless to say, we saw the communists marching in, looking out the window. So that expedited our visit real quick. And again, we left without anything. Just clothes on our back. We had to get out right then and there, and we were the last boat out.
So I want to ask you, and maybe for you, Deborah, even more than Ely, because after having read this memoir, An Uncommon Journey, it seems that, Ely, you were older, you were kind of the favorite son or the favorite child. You had a little bit of a halo of, can-doism about you. But you, Deborah, you had been much more frightened. You had been much more vulnerable. Talk about what do you feel is the impact of the kind of fear that you lived under, the uncertainty, the refugee status? What has been the psychological impact on you, or what was the impact on you as a child?
Well, it first of all, you get withdrawn, completely withdrawn, and it's very hard to understand what's happening around you. I think you become extremely insecure. You tend to not believe what people tell you. You really don't have a sense of trust for anybody. You tend to look over your shoulders quite often. It's left me with a lot of these feelings, which are still there today, where it's very difficult to trust someone if they say, like my mother, we're leaving tomorrow and it hasn't happened in 10 years. So what your mother tells you hasn't happened, why would you believe anyone else? I think it leaves you in a feeling of, I wouldn't want to say uselessness, but it's close to being like looked down at. In other words, I always felt the persecution was always there. The fact that it wasn't really necessarily being Jewish on my part, we were looked down upon because we didn't have anything. So I remember all my life feeling that one of these days I must make something of myself. I don't want to continuously be looked down on. I felt sorry for. And it gives you that kind of sense of you don't belong anywhere. Mm-hmm. You're basically homeless forever. Even though you have a home, you don't feel it.
You develop a sense of exclusion. Like I was born stateless, and I always felt stateless. I never felt that I belonged to a specific country or to a specific place. I always felt like an observer, actually, of life, standing outside the window and looking in. I never felt that inside looking out.
That was Eli Wax and his sister Deborah Strobin. I spoke to them both in Wax's New York apartment about the memoir they co-authored, Uncommon Journey. You can read their memories of the liberation of the Shanghai ghetto by going to writersvoice.net, inspired by his Uncommon Journey. And you can hear Writer's Voice anytime you want. Just subscribe to our free podcast and sign up for our newsletter to find out what's on the literary menu. That's all at writersvoice.net, all one word. Next up, why do some people act to rescue those who are threatened by persecution, while others just stand by? We talk with author I.L. Press after the break. Stay tuned. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Why is it that some people risk their jobs, reputations, or even their lives to stand up to evil, while most of their peers remain silent or even become perpetrators themselves? That's a question A.L. Press asks in his remarkable book, Beautiful Souls. Press explores the stories of four individuals: a Swiss police commander who, against orders, allowed Jews fleeing Germany entry into Switzerland, a Serb who rescued Croats during the Bosnian War, an elite Israeli soldier who became a refusenik, and a financial advisor who blew the whistle on her employer's Ponzi scheme. His thoughtful examination of their stories sheds new light on what motivates those beautiful souls who, as the book's subtitle says, say no, break ranks, and heed the voice of conscience in dark times. A.L. Press, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you. Thank you for having me on.
I wanted to start out actually with the title of this book because it has a dual facet. It's not tongue-in-cheek in one way, but another way, it has an ironic source.
Yes, I'm so glad you pointed that out, because when I was slightly afraid that when people see the title, Beautiful Souls, what they will think of is a kind of sanctimonious celebration
of saintly heroes, of which I think we already have too many. Beautiful souls, which isn't to say, by the way, that the characters in the book do indeed undertake heroic acts, but the term beautiful souls in Hebrew, it's yafei nefesh, and it carries the connotation of being almost too pure or naive, in a sense, a bleeding heart. And it is a term that Israeli soldiers are loath to have applied to themselves. And I tell the story in the book of a soldier named Avner Wishnitzer, who served for 3.5 years in the most elite unit of the Israeli army. He grew up very much dreaming of doing so and of defending his country and in a very patriotic milieu, which he internalized and absorbed. After his service, he went on a trip to the occupied territories, to a place in the West Bank, where for the first time he saw Palestinians being mistreated, and it really startled him, and it set him off on an awakening that eventually led him to inform his commander that he did not want to serve in the occupied territories, which is not to say he didn't want to serve at all. Indeed, he wanted to continue serving, but not in the occupied territories. And as he went through that awakening, he told me there was another dramatic encounter he had with a soldier where he thought, he was thinking of the soldier looking at him, and he was thinking, I hope he doesn't see me as a beautiful soul. So Avner, this soldier who's going through this transformation, is afraid to be seen in this way. And that is, in a sense, I think, I chose the title because the truth of the matter is we don't unequivocally admire people who break ranks, generally speaking. Very often, we do admire them from a distance when they question what other governments or other societies are doing, or say after the fact. You know, we find it easy to look back at the Holocaust, for example, and admire the people who went against the grain in that context. But when it's closer to home, in our own society, in our own workplace, in our own military unit, if you will, it's much more difficult.
Yeah, and, you know, you mentioned the Holocaust. I mean, I think of the German resistance who were heroes, certainly some of them more than others, but they went against the grain. It took decades for the German government to recognize them.
And not just the German government. Another story in my book, the first story in the book is actually about a Swiss police captain named Paul Gruninger, who in 1938 was given the order to prevent Jewish refugees from entering Switzerland. He was the head of the police in an area that bordered Austria, which had just been annexed by Nazi Germany, and where Jews were fleeing in terror. And this police captain, Paul Gruninger, refused to enforce this unjust law and allowed hundreds, possibly thousands, of Jews into Switzerland until he was caught. Now, he thought that when the facts and the circumstances came to light, he would be exonerated and certainly not suffer a terrible long-term repercussions. As I tell the story in the book, Paul Gruninger was officially rehabilitated and recognized for his courage by the Swiss government in 1993, which was 21 years after he died and 45 years after he refused to enforce a law many Swiss citizens today look back on with shame. It took that long, and we're not talking about Nazi Germany, we're talking about Switzerland here. So again, one of the themes of the book is that those who stand by their principles in such situations are all too often left to their own devices, vilified, ignored, and yet after a certain amount of time and distance sets in, they come to be appreciated.
And you also talk of two other individuals, and we're going to go back and talk about hopefully each one of these in more depth. There is somebody who takes his life into his own hands and also endures the scorn and reprobation of his peers. This is the Serb named, now am I going to pronounce his name correctly? I'm going to do his nickname, Acho, is that right?
That's right. Yes, his full name is Alexander Yevtich, but his nickname and how he's known to his friends is Acho. And indeed, this is in some ways, to me, the most remarkable story. I came upon a Serbian man who, during the height of the Balkan Wars, when Serbia and Croatia were at war, when Serbs were supposed to look at Croats as their enemies and vice versa, this guy, who is a Serb, risks his own life. He finds himself in a prison, and he's a detention center, and he's asked by the Serbs running the center to help them by picking out all of the Serbs in a mass of prisoners who have just been captured, because the Serbs knew that among those prisoners there were not only Croats, but also some Serbs, and they had no other way of identifying these Serbs because they weren't from the town where these prisoners came from. Acho was from that town. So he proceeds to stand up, and he starts calling people's names and signaling to them and kicking at their feet and telling them to go to another part of the prison where they won't be abused, where they won't be harmed. But he makes up names for these men. He starts picking Croats without telling anyone, and he refers to them by fake Serbian names, in a sense deceiving the guards in order to help the Croats who were amassed in this prison. Had he been caught, he very likely could have been shot, and the consequences undoubtedly would have been dire and severe. So it's a remarkable act of courage, and I use that story and other stories in the book to explore what it is that overtakes people in such situations and makes them do not the wrong thing, which we read about so often, but rather the right thing.
We're talking with A.L. Press about his wonderful book, Beautiful Souls, Saying No, Breaking Ranks, and Heeding the Voice of Conscience in Dark Times. I found this book personally very important to me because my father was one of these nonconformists. He was a Dutchman during the war in Holland. He hid a Jewish man in his apartment for 3 years and was also involved with finding hiding places and building hiding places for other Jews to escape the Nazi Holocaust. I mean, and we have to say that Holland was one of the places outside of Poland, was second only to Poland in the high percentage of its Jewish population that was murdered. And I've always wondered, why did he do it? Because he was not a politically involved man. He wasn't an altruist particularly. He wasn't somebody who lived his life according to high ideals, and yet he risked his life over and over again throughout the war, ultimately fleeing the Gestapo and ending up in the United States because of his actions. And this book really finally, after the 10 years I've been thinking about this and writing about it, explained my father to me. So let's talk about what are some of the motivations, what are the things that drive these nonconformists to be able to do the right thing, and start with Gruninger, because he's an interesting case. I mean, you wouldn't look at him and say that he was a nonconformist, and yet he ended up being so.
Correct. And by the way, that's a remarkably moving story about your father. And I have to say, one of the pleasures of publishing the book is hearing how many people, sometimes in dramatic ways, as in your case, and sometimes in less dramatic ways, feel that in some ways, the dilemmas and the sort of choices I describe being made in the book do resonate for them. In terms of what compelled Gruninger, you're absolutely right. He was the last person the people who knew him would have suspected of breaking ranks, in a sense, of being this kind of bold and dramatic nonconformist who would not enforce the law. He was he voted conservative. He sang in a church choir. He was not an outspoken political guy and not an open and ardent anti-fascist. This is in the late 1930s in Switzerland when there were such people. So why did he do it? And when I look at Gruninger's case, there are a couple of things that really stand out about him. The first is that he made what his superiors considered was a mistake, what the authorities in Switzerland considered a mistake. he did not delegate the task of turning away Jewish refugees to someone below him. Here he was, the police captain. He could have said, okay, I won't go to the border myself. I'll have other people do it. It's an ugly business. Why do it myself? Gruninger let refugees come directly to the police headquarters in St. Gallen, where he was stationed. He went to the border himself. He saw the desperation in the people's eyes. And as he told his daughter, who I interviewed when I went to St. Gallen and who is still alive, he felt he could do nothing else. Now, we have to take that a little bit with a grain of salt because we know he could have done something else. But nevertheless, there's something very true in the sense that we know from history, we know from scientific experiments that have been done, that the closer you are to the harm, to the faces of the people you may harm in undertaking an act, the more likely it is that you will find it difficult to follow through and resist. And this speaks to a kind of basic empathy and decency that I think is in most people. I tell a story in my book about U.S. soldiers during World War II. The Army did a study of infantrymen during World War II who, in face-to-face battles, it turns out 85% of the infantrymen did not shoot in close-range battles with the enemy. They did not aim and shoot at the enemy. They aimed above the heads of the enemy, or they didn't fire at all. The closer proximity and the ability to actually see the potential harm of one's acts raises the resistance in people, and it did so in Gruninger. Conversely, and this is a real problem in our modern world, if you are distant from the suffering, if you just make the decision and don't see the consequences of it, it becomes all too easy to conform and to go along. So that was one very, very important factor in Gruninger's story. It wasn't the only one. There was also the fact that, ironically enough, Gruninger's Swiss patriotism, his sort of traditional belief in Swiss values, played a very important role as well, because he was, as I said, he voted conservative. And he was also very much a believer in the Swiss tradition of sheltering refugees, of letting the persecuted from other parts of the world and other neighboring states take refuge in Switzerland. This is very much an important part of Swiss patriotism and national identity, and Gruninger really believed it. And again, this is why he thought he would be forgiven when they found out what he did. Of course, he was wrong about that.
Mm. You point out that in the case of Aco, the Serbian who rescued Croats, that he was imprisoned with briefly. You point out that there were several things going on with him and group identity. I mean, one would have thought group identity would not have played a role. And ironically, in a way, it did, although not his group identity as a Serb. But there was something else that was also playing a role, and you call it his inner directedness, his ability. He was a happy man, even though he was ostracized by both the Serbian community as well as the Croat community.
Yes, that's right. Each story in the book is really interrogates and explores a different form of resistance. So in Gruninger's case, which I've described, he's saying no to an unjust law. In Aco's case, he's saying no to the group, to less to obedience than to conformity and to peer pressure. And one of the striking things about him, and it isn't necessarily his most becoming feature in every aspect of life, but he really was this inner-directed type who seemed to possess a certain amount of immunity from peer pressure and caring what everyone... It's too much about what everyone around him thought. I met him in 2008. This was 17 years after he had done this brave thing as a Serb of helping Croats. And yet in the town he lived in, which is now still a mixed Serb-Croat city, he wasn't really seen as one of us by either the Serbs or the Croats. Among the Serbs, it was known that he had helped the other side, quote-unquote, and this town is unfortunately still deeply divided by conflicting memories about the war, who was right and who was wrong and who suffered. So the Serbs see Aco and saw him as a kind of traitor, someone who went to the other side. Now, you would think, well, the Croats would welcome him. Here he was, this man who heroically and at risk to his own life helped spare hundreds of Croats from mistreatment and abuse in a detention camp. Unfortunately, this wasn't the case. There were people who recognized him, including some of the people he saved, who I met and interviewed. But a lot of people in the town did not welcome him as one of them, a lot of Croats, simply because he's a Serb. And to recognize a Serb as having done something heroic in the war would, in a sense, doesn't fit into the Croatian narrative, which is that Serbs only did horrible things during the war, and the heroes of the war were all Croats. So here is this guy, you know, 17 years after the fact, still not being recognized, and yet, as you allude to, it seemed that I was more bothered by this, and some of the men he helped were more bothered by this than Aco himself was bothered by this. He went around town, and he said to me, "Look, I wake up, I look in the mirror, I'm a happy man. I know that I'm right with myself." And so that really did strike me as one of the important things in enabling him to do what he did.
So, Drew Adamek, my associate producer, has a question.
Yes.
It's related to this idea of the narrative and the narrative hardening. Does it become more difficult, particularly in a place that's still so deeply divided, even physically and emotionally, does it become more difficult to confront these issues of the past and to exhibit bravery and to exhibit nonconformity as these narratives harden over time?
No question. I actually thought that it would be fairly easy by 2008 to find a character or two for my book in the Balkans who had, in a sense, done the right thing, who had resisted ethnic nationalism and the demonization of the other groups and helped people and sheltered them and done something of this sort. I met with Natasha Kandic, a very well-known human rights activist based in Belgrade, and said to her, "Can you help me find such a person?" And she said, "Look, there are such people in every town and village, and they are part of what inspired me as I was doing my work, but they won't talk to you. You will not find someone who will talk to you because they're still afraid to be outed for what they did, even though we can say now one would think they did the right thing. But within the towns they live in, which are often deeply divided and cleaved by these ethnic tensions and divisions, it was still uncomfortable for people to, in a sense, come out and say, hey, this is what I did, and I think it was right. I did eventually find one person to write about, this guy, Alexander Yevtich. He's not alone. There were others. And indeed, in his story, one of the most inspiring things about his story is that it turns out, before he acted, he, in a sense, had some co-conspirators, some people who helped him. And this was at the time when he was a Serb trapped in the then Croatian-controlled city of Vukovar. He was in great danger, and he was sheltered by his girlfriend, who was a Croat. And there were people in the building who knew he was there and who did not reveal his identity. So one of the themes of the book, and a very important one, is this kind of mutual support that takes place. We tend to think that those who don't conform in these situations act entirely alone. And yet, in every story I tell, it turns out there is an important co-conspirator or a collaborator of some kind who shows a kind of sympathy or empathy or willingness to display courage along with the person I write about. And this is very important in lowering the fear level and making the person feel slightly less alone.
We're talking with AL Press about his book, Beautiful Souls. It's about those who go against the stream of their culture, of their group, to do the right thing. You give the example, as you've talked before, I mean, the example that gives you the title of the book, of Avner Vishnitzer. Is that how to pronounce his name?
Yes, yes.
Vishnitzer. You know, there he was going against a powerful tide of group identity, one that I know well. I'm an American Jew. I know how difficult it is to oppose Israeli policy towards Palestinians is something I've done for a long time, but it took me a long time to actually talk about it with my family. You were born in Israel and came to the U.S., so I'm sure you know of what I speak. Tell us a little bit about what helped Avner. I mean, ironically, in a way, it was precisely his identity as a Jew.
Yes, mm-hmm. Well, I would say Avner, in Avner's case, his refusal to serve in the occupied territories was very much rooted in his love of his country. That may sound strange to people who will see him as a traitor, as someone who broke ranks, but as I said, here was a guy who grew up on a kibbutz dreaming of serving in the most elite unit of the Israeli army because he felt he was defending a people who had suffered terrible violence and persecution and needed a strong defense. And he did that with great pride. When he saw the army protecting settlers, Jewish settlers, in the West Bank who were mistreating and harassing and abusing Palestinians, it became a crisis of conscience for him. He couldn't square what he saw happening with this idealistic notion and view he had of his country and of the idealism that, in a sense, led him into the army. So he becomes a refusenik. As he starts thinking about whether he should actually break ranks, and it was a tremendously hard decision for him, if for a soldier in a country where military service is really a measure of belonging, as he put it to me, it would be hard to overstate how foreign to him the idea of refusing was initially, and it really took him a long time. It was a slow, gradual process. But as he thought about it, he did think back to earlier generations in his family, and he thought back to his grandfather, who was, in a sense, a Holocaust survivor, somehow escaped the clutches of the Gestapo and ended up in Palestine and what then became eventually Israel. Avner was taking a course in which he saw a film and read about the Holocaust and read about how it wasn't just the people who did wrong. It was all the people who watched what was being done and didn't take a stand and didn't do anything. And that memory, that thought, really hit home for him. And as he said to me, look, it's an entirely different context. The Holocaust is one thing, the occupation of the West Bank is another, but in both cases, he came to feel there were injustices being done that one could sit back and do nothing about or take a stand. And for Avner, as he thought about his own personal history, he felt he had to take a stand, and that is eventually what led him to refuse.
You yourself, as I mentioned before, you were born in Israel. In writing about Avner and writing this story, I think you're making pretty clear your own feelings about Israeli policy towards Palestinians. You just mentioned the bystanders. I think this is, at least I've certainly known it as a struggle within myself. How do I move from being a bystander to speaking out? Is this a struggle that you had within yourself?
Absolutely. And I think I wrote the book in a sense to explore something that has always, that I've always thought about for reasons that have to do with my own history. As you mentioned, I was born in Israel. I grew up in the United States. When I turned 18, cousins and friends of mine were entering the Israeli army just as the first Palestinian intifada erupted. This was an uprising in which Palestinians protested living under military occupation. And for the first time in my life, I looked at what soldiers my age were being asked to do, stop people at checkpoints, arrest young children, often, who were throwing stones or protesting. And I felt lucky not to be in their shoes. And I had grown up with a very idealistic view of the Israeli army, much like the character I write about. And that was the first glimmer of doubt and the first discomfort. And since that time, I have thought, you know, what would I have done if I had been asked to do something as a soldier, I felt was clearly wrong. Would I have been willing to risk being seen as, you know, disloyal, as outside the consensus? And so in writing the book, I am very much exploring and trying to go into something that I think resonates very much for me. It also resonates for me because the other side of my family, my maternal grandparents and my mother, are Holocaust survivors. And I naturally grew up very much revering the rescuers, the Raoul Wallenbergs, the stories of those who were willing to go against the grain and rescue and shelter Jews during World War II. So from both sides of my family, I've thought a lot about these things and also thought about, again, how much easier it is for us to admire the people who break ranks when we would benefit, or when in a sense they are questioning and opposing someone else's beliefs. But of course, it's much harder when they're questioning or opposing our own beliefs.
And regrettably, we don't have enough time to talk about your final example in the book, which is of an American whistleblower, which I think brings up a lot of those questions, especially in this time where there's so much pressure coming even from the administration against whistleblowers, making it even more difficult to do their job. Do you have any final thoughts about the contemporary context and what your book can say to us in terms of that?
Absolutely. There is an American whistleblower, a woman, a financial broker, who refused to sell a product that turned out to be a fraudulent product at the Stanford Financial Group, where she was working. She got fired from the company. The company was later found to be orchestrating the second largest Ponzi scheme in U.S. history. And I include, her name was Layla Weidler, I include her story in the book because I very much believe that these issues of what do you do when you're thrust into a morally compromising situation and when you're told to do something, you sort of suspect something is wrong here. What should I do? I really do feel that is resonating, and it resonates in all our lives, but it plays out in this country in contexts ranging from corporate boardrooms to Wall Street to sometimes universities and school classrooms and workplaces and sometimes neighborhoods. And I hope that the book takes these dramatic stories that I described that took place in other places and by the end leaves readers really thinking about how do I think about these things in the situations I find myself in. And I very much believe that we don't do enough, unfortunately, to listen to the voices of those like Layla Weidler who do warn us, you know, something's wrong here.
The book is, and I recommend all you listeners to go out and read this wonderful book. It is Beautiful Souls, Saying No, Breaking Ranks, and Heeding the Voice of Conscience in Dark Times. AL Press, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you so much for having me on.
You can read an excerpt from Beautiful Souls by going to writersvoice.net. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. You can also sign up to get the show delivered straight to your inbox or subscribe to the podcast and the newsletter. And follow us on Twitter at Writer's Voice, all one word. Then check out my blog, Francesca Rhiannon at blogspot.com. You can find lots of cool stuff there. The Writer's Voice webmaster is Bill Way. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.